Namaste. So, this evening we'll finish Raja Yoga, which is the last chapter in the section that we call the Yoga of Integral Knowledge in the synthesis of yoga. Sri Aurobindo has written to this point about the preparatory elements to practice this kingly yoga, which have you to address the life inside and the life outside. The yamas are meant to teach us to restrain, to hold ourselves in firm alliance with the higher principles that we want to have actuated in our lives. And so we learn not to harm, not to force our will upon another, ahimsa. We learn to speak truth. In fact, there's a tantric tradition that if one knows how to preserve one's speech power and focus it, that at some point, so much have you only spoken truth that what you say will in and of itself become true. Vaksiddhi, the power of fulfilling speech, comes to you. But in these preliminaries, simply to begin to accord with what is true is important. Asteya, not to reach out, not to grasp, brahmacharya, to place your energies in the path that leads towards Brahman, towards reality, towards that truth that constantly expands, constantly grows. That is Brahman. Then aparigraha, not to grasp. These are the five yamas. They make us deal with the world differently. And then the niyamas begin us on a psychological cultivation of virtues that make us ready to practice yoga in a larger way. So, shaucha, to establish purity. Purity in thought, purity in feeling, not simply purity in the body. Santosha, to be content. You have already deposited yourself in a human body, a precious birth, given only once in a while. We have to earn this position upon the earth, and we're given all the energies and the circumstances that we ourselves have chosen. And now, let us do our best in the mission we have been assigned and not wander into somebody else's mission. We have our own work. Let us attend to it. Tapas, to pour oneself energetically into action, to concentrate. It is this in us which is an emulation of what creates the universe. When the conscious being, the only one who is, presses upon itself, then comes forth the manifestation of this world. Always the worlds were contained in infinite being, but because there was this energization, now it becomes clear, the very sense of manifestation. Swadhyaya is the next. And Swadhyaya is self-study. We often think of it in terms of reading books, appropriate literature to refine our consciousness. But actually, whatever you read in books, you have to apply to yourself. You have to be able to give yourself an honest look and say, there I need to put a little plaster. There the air is coming in. And then the last is Ishvara Pranidhana. That is, to be conscious, to be aware, to be attuned to that supreme conscious being whose energy is deployed in all these worlds and all these beings, and to be able to recognize the tracery of its motion in all circumstances that are in front of you, behind you, above you, beneath you. Everywhere you look, there is the signature of the divine. Can you recognize it? If you can do that, then you are getting close to the mysteries which underlie this whole universe. So these two sets, yamas and niyamas, prepare us. They prepare us to learn how to compose ourselves, to take a seat in which we can practice yoga. And this is where we pick up Sri Aurobindo's language here. It is here, when this foundation has been secured, that the practice of asana and pranayama come in and can then bear their perfect fruits. By itself, the control of the mind and moral being only puts our normal consciousness into the right preliminary condition. It cannot bring about that evolution or manifestation of the higher psychic being which is necessary for the greater aims of yoga. Now let's pause and remember that Sri Aurobindo is writing this in the 19-teens. Yes, 1918, I believe, is when this essay was written. When he says higher psychic being here, he is not writing with that clear conception that he and the mother, his radiant collaborator, brought into the parlance of integral yoga, say in the mid-1920s, where the psychic being began to take a prominent place in the practice of his yoga. No, here, the higher psychic being is referring to those inner parts of our nature. Likely as not, he could be referring to the subliminal nature, what we would now call the true mental being, or the inner mind, or the true vital being, or the inner vital, etc. He was influenced in part at this stage by the writings of Swami Vivekananda, who often used this phraseology in his writing in, well, Jnana Yoga, Raja Yoga, some of his more popular books, with which Sri Aurobindo had strong familiarity. So I just want to spend a moment in disambiguation so these terms aren't confusing to us. Back to his paragraph. In order to bring about this manifestation, the present notice of the vital and physical body with the mental being has to be loosened and the way made clear for the ascent through the greater psychic being to the union with the superconscient Purusha. So here he makes it plain. In other words, this sort of occluded, not fully conscious collaboration of body, life, and mind in its normal iteration blocks our awareness of these subtler parts of our nature. And if we can loosen that connection, that notice, as he says, if we can plow our way through that, then we gain access to these superior inner planes, which can allow us to rise into the superconscient. All of these planes, all of these postures of our being, and then the many postures all brought into one collective, which we think of as ourself, but actually represent different conversations, physical, vital, and mental, between Purusha and Prakriti, between the real being inside and nature as deployed at that level, all speak to a reality which draws, which derives from the supreme Purusha, the superconscient Purusha above, in its relationship with a more conscious nature, is precipitated here, but is a mere emulation. So to get to answer the real questions here in our cosmos, we have to get back to the origin of the cosmos, both in consciousness and nature. So, how do we get through that notice? He says, this can be done by pranayama. Asana is used by the Raja Yoga only in its easiest and most natural position, that naturally taken by the body when seated and gathered together. But with the back and head strictly erect and in a straight line so that there may be no deflection of the spinal cord. In other words, we are not going to master all the postures, all the asanas in the catalog of Hatha Yoga. Take the one that is natural to you, whether you sit in a chair, whether you sit on the floor, but the one thing you must do is keep the back straight and the head lifted up. The object of the latter rule is obviously connected with the theory of the six chakras and the circulation of the vital energy between the Muladhara and the Brahmarandra. So at the base is the root chakra, Muladhara, then Swadhisthana, then Manipura, then Anahata, then Vishuddha, finally Agnya, and at the top, Sahasrara. Brahmarandra opens into that. That cleavage here at the top is the passage through which Brahma, the God, comes down into you or you go up to him. The Raja Yogic Pranayama purifies and clears the nervous system. So pranayama is meant to bring that power of purity that we've been establishing in the niyamas into a greater force and clears out the nervous system. What is the nervous system? That is where vitality meets the body function. It enables us to circulate the vital energy equally through the body and direct it also where we will according to need, and thus maintain a perfect health and soundness of the body and the vital being. It gives us control of all the five habitual operations of the vital energy in the system, and at the same time breaks down the habitual divisions by which only the ordinary mechanical processes of the vitality are possible to the normal life. So, several things here. Purification, then circulation. Remember, the energy doesn't just go up. We don't just go up, but we go up and we come around and we circulate all these life energies. There are five pranas. We've listed them elsewhere. But then to place the prana through direct attention to strike, perhaps, at a particular chakra, where a center in us organizes a world of being, and to bring wakefulness or new energy to it, to give it a particular mission out here in the world around, and then to maintain perfect health. So there are several functions that go on all at once with the exercise of pranayama. And it breaks down the routine actions and gives possibility to expanded actions and roles for prana to play. It opens entirely the six centers of the psychophysical system and brings into the waking consciousness the power of the awakened Shakti and the light of the unveiled Purusha on each of the ascending planes. There we go again, the relationship of Purusha and Prakriti. And so one strikes at the base of the Muladhara with the flow of prana directed from above. It energizes, stimulates, stirs into wakefulness that sleeping serpent. And Kundalini rises. And this is the power of life. And as it comes up, engages and releases the Purusha on each of these nodal points. So that, awake here, awake there, and all the way up to the top. All of them bring greater power and more concerted harmony to the whole being. Where before, some chakras may be partly open, partly closed, now they're all open. They can be aware of each other, and rather than compete with each other, can work in alliance for the common will of the Purusha, whose light, attained to above, can cascade down. And it's a light that has power, because Purusha has been reunited with Prakriti, or the source of Prakriti above. Kundalini, rising from the below, has rejoined Mahakundali above, who is one with the Purusha. And so integration becomes possible. You see the charm of it. All the life can act in concert with each other. This gets back to the ideal of the integral yoga, no? Then he writes, coupled with the use of the mantra, it brings the divine energy into the body and prepares for and facilitates that concentration in samadhi, which is the crown of the Raja Yogic method. Divine energy, obviously, this is the Shakti. Rising from below, it seems to be Kundalini. Coming from above, it's the superconscient Mahakundali. Samadhi is where they become one, where the inner experience becomes one with the supreme energy. And there's a conscious fusion of the individual soul into the universal power. And a change, substantial, powerful, transformative. Raja yogic concentration is divided into four stages. It commences with the drawing both of the mind and senses from outward things, pratyahara, proceeds to the holding of the one object of concentration to the exclusion of all other ideas and mental activities, dharana, then to the prolonged absorption of the mind in this object, dhyana, and finally to the complete ingoing of the consciousness by which it is lost to all outward mental activity in the oneness of samadhi. Yes, samadhi. The real object of this mental discipline is to draw away the mind from the outward and the mental world into union with the divine being. Yes, this is a passage, a seagoing voyage in which one is trying to reach the inner ocean of infinity. Therefore, in the first three stages, use has to be made of some mental means or support by which the mind, accustomed to run about from object to object, shall fix on one alone, and that one must be something which represents the idea of the divine. So, for those who were visually oriented, it may be an Ishta Devata, the figure, the very figure of that conscious being whom you love most, your chosen god or goddess. For another, it may be the empowering mantra, and the recitation of which over and over and over again awakens the reality that is inside it. So, whatever the choice, whether it's mantra or whether it's form, one concentrates upon that, and the gulf begins to diminish. There is a meeting, there is a communion, finally, there is a union. And along the way, all that has been outside, all the distractions have faded. And rather than compete, all that is around you in the environment comes to support, to bless, to encourage. And there's a happy movement towards this deep communion, which becomes identity, which is itself the sign of grace. It is usually a name or a form or a mantra by which the thought can be fixed in the soul knowledge or adoration of the Lord. Ishwa Pranidhan. By this concentration on the idea, the mind enters from the idea into its reality, into which it sinks, silent, absorbed, unified. This is the traditional method. There are, however, others which are equally of a Raja Yogic character, since they use the mental and psychical being as key. Some of them are directed rather to the quiescence of the mind than to its immediate absorption, as the discipline by which the mind is simply watched and allowed to exhaust its habit of vagrant thought in a purposeless running from which it feels all sanction, purpose, and interest withdrawn, and that more strenuous and rapidly effective, by which all outward-going thought is excluded and the mind forced to sink into itself, where in its absolute quietude it can only reflect the pure being or pass away into its superconscient existence. The method differs, the object and the result are the same. And I believe that Swami Vivekananda also wrote about these as avenues of access. Obviously, the first is a passive mastery, simply watching all the current of events on the front without identifying with any of it. And the other is dynamic. So you'll recall, Sri Aurobindo was actually master of both of these processes, but in 1908, when Lele asked him to sit and simply look at the thoughts that came swimming in from outside, because indeed he discovered that they did not arise from within, but came from a universal consciousness, a universal mind, which is exterior to what one took to be oneself, he could, through the application of his will, stop them. Another would come, he would stop it. He writes about this in a couple places in his letters on yoga and also in Savitri. This is a method that can be very effective for some. But if you find that it takes practice, you can simply impartially witness the events that occur before you and not identify and get to the same result. That is, you're free of attachment to any movement on the surface. And here we go. Here it might be supposed the whole action and aim of Raja Yoga must end, and that quiet. For its action is the stilling of the ways of consciousness, its manifold activities, chitta-vritti. First, through a habitual replacing of the turbid rajasic activities by the quiet and luminous sattvic, then by the stilling of all activities. And its object is to enter into silent communion of soul and unity with the divine. This is Yoga Sutra's first chapter, second sutra, no? As a matter of fact, we find that the system of Raja Yoga includes other objects, such as the practice and use of occult powers, some of which seem to be unconnected with and even inconsistent with its main purpose. Well, here we get into chapter 4 of the Yoga Sutras, etc. And let's just again distinguish between Raja Yoga, as typically understood in the Yoga Sutras. It is Swami Vivekananda that drew the equal marks between the two in the late 19th century. And many, many people, of course, have fallen in line after that. But Raja Yoga actually is defined as something different and is recognized in earlier works that I think we've touched upon recently. The Amanaska text, which is a Shaiva tantric text, which refers to mantra and laya and hatha yoga as precedent to the practice of Raja Yoga, the royal way. This arose in the 11th century, 12th century at the absolute latest, and does not follow all the enumerations that the Yoga Sutras follow, which is a much earlier work, 3rd, 4th, 5th century CE. So several hundred years separate them. Swami Vivekananda was a little hasty in drawing that equation. Back to the siddhis. These powers or siddhis are indeed frequently condemned as dangers and distractions which draw away the yogin from his sole legitimate aim of divine union. On the way, therefore, it would naturally seem as if they ought to be avoided. And once the goal is reached, it would seem that they are then frivolous and superfluous. But Raja Yoga is a psychic science, a vidya, and it includes the attainment of all the higher states of consciousness and their powers by which the mental being rises towards the superconscient, as well as its ultimate and supreme possibility of union with the highest. So all the stages of ascent, each step on the ladder, has to be carefully mapped out and recorded, the experiences and the possibilities duly noted and shared with people who will follow, with souls who aspire to those same heights. Ultimately, when one reaches the highest, if that highest deems that these discovered powers should be utilized and fixed in mind and energized in life energies and established even in the body, then so it will be. One has no personal will anymore. It is the divine's will that is done through the awakened individual. Moreover, the yogin, while in the body, is not always mentally inactive and sunk in samadhi, and an account of the powers and states which are possible to him on the higher planes of his being is necessary to the completeness of the science, the vidya. These powers and experiences belong first to the vital and mental planes above this physical in which we live, and are natural to the soul in the subtle body. So here he's referring to what he would later call the supraphysical planes, the inner planes of being, the inside of the cosmos. As the dependence on the physical body decreases, these abnormal activities become possible and even manifest themselves without being sought for. They can be acquired and fixed by processes which the science gives, and their use then becomes subject to the will. Or they can be allowed to develop of themselves and used only when they come, or when the divine within moves us to use them. Or else, even though thus naturally developing and acting, they may be rejected in a single-minded devotion to the one supreme goal of the yoga. So this is the development of the mastery, Aishwarya, which comes in the fulfilling stages of tantric practice. Secondly, there are fuller, greater powers belonging to the supramental planes, which are the very powers of the divine in his spiritually and supramentally ideative being. Ideative because they are the real idea. When this vast consciousness of Vijnana conceives, what it conceives is real. What it conceives has power, instinctive in it, so it can realize itself. So these powers are altogether different from what seem to us as siddhis in the superphysical planes. Wonderful though they be, they are mere derivations and partial empowerments of what are native to the supramental plane. These cannot be acquired at all securely or integrally by personal effort. No, this is not something that the ego or the mere liberated individual can master and possess, but can only come from above. They descend as a signature of grace, or else can become natural to the man if and when he ascends beyond mind and lives in the spiritual being, power, consciousness, and ideation. So, in other words, when you have left this triple realm of matter, life, and mind, and can dwell natively in these infinite fields of Satchit-Ananda, infinite consciousness, infinite delight, based on infinite being, and the idea of that infinity comes into bright expression through the supramental truth consciousness, then they can work in you. You are now transcendent, cosmic, and individual all at once. So this grace in descent is possible. This can be normalized by our ascent from this triple plane into that. So, if he still continues to be active in the world existence, they then become not abnormal and laboriously acquired siddhis, but simply the very nature and method of his action, if he still continues to be active in the world existence. Well, Sri Aurobindo has tipped his hand and shown that indeed this is the suffusion of the divine consciousness into what here is partial and incomplete, which he intends fully to complete as part of a cosmic yoga. On the whole, for an integral yoga, the special methods of Raja Yoga and Hatha Yoga may be useful at times in certain stages of the progress, but are not indispensable. It is true that their principal aims must be included in the integrality of the yoga, but they can be brought about by other means. For the methods of the integral yoga must be mainly spiritual. And dependence on physical methods or fixed psychic or psychophysical processes on a large scale would be the substitution of a lower for a higher action. We shall have occasion to touch upon this question later when we come to the final principle of synthesis in method, to which our examination of the different yogas is intended to lead. So he refers to the yoga of self-perfection, not to the next that he would take up, the yoga of divine love. So he is aiming at a synthesis in which all four possibilities could be united. And this is possible to bring works and knowledge and love together through a fourth integrating, self-perfecting method, which seizes on this old tantric concept of the Shakti as the sole effective force for all attainment. A direct quote from him, which we may get to later, which results in this transformation, which is his preoccupation. So it is by ascent into union with Ishvara Ishwari, with the supreme power of the Divine Mother, that can effectuate this grand synthesis, which he chalked out in the Sapta Chatushtaya and began to write about in the Synthesis of Yoga, and entered into it in the Yoga of Self-Perfection and left it midstream. So this Yoga of Integral Knowledge that we have completed reading tonight focuses on the attainment of oneness with the divine in the field of knowledge, so that the mind, limited and partial, can become sunlit, illuminated, lifted up, can transcend itself. But that same oneness can be attained at every level of the being. Integral knowledge is not based on the possession of books. Apara vidya, integral knowledge, is the summary sovereignty of the soul that has attended its sessions with the divine and ascended into complete union with the supreme. We begin with finding the spark within, which becomes a flame, which mounts into a fire, which becomes a cosmic fire, Vaishvanara Agni, and then reveals the pathway upwards to the Supreme. So this knowledge must include the awakening soul, must embrace the widening cosmic spirit, but arrive at the transcendent, so that all three terms of being are available, manifest here and now in us. When we do that individually, then that individual becomes the basis of the cosmic change. You become the center of a conscious community that will be built around you. It is inevitable that all are drawn to light. Wherever you are, when you awaken to the soul, you're the living center. You are the spark that could become a conscious community, an ashram, and connect beyond that. Next week, we'll begin reading the Yoga of Divine Love, following the same method that we've used in these other sections of the synthesis of yoga. We'll have occasion to look at the Shandilya Bhakti Sutras and also Narada Bhakti Sutras, and bring them in when appropriate. Tonight, though, I want to read a passage from Savitri in Book 1, the Book of Beginnings, and we'll start on page 26 in Canto 3, The Yoga of the Soul's Release. A pure perception lent its lucent joy. Its intimate vision waited not to think. It enveloped all nature in a single glance. It looked into the very self of things. Deceived no more by form, he saw the soul. In beings it knew what lurked to them unknown. It seized the idea in mind, the wish in the heart. It plucked out from gray folds of secrecy the motives which from their own sight men hide. He felt the beating life in other men invade him with their happiness and their grief. Their love, their anger, their unspoken hopes entered in currents or in pouring waves into the immobile ocean of his calm. He heard the inspired sound of his own thoughts re-echoed in the vault of other minds. The world's thought streams traveled into his ken. His inner self grew near to others' selves and bore a kinship's weight, a common tie, yet stood untouched, king of itself, alone. A magical accord quickened and attuned to ethereal symphonies, the old earthy strings. It raised the servitors of mind and life to be happy partners in the soul's response. Tissue and nerve were turned to sensitive chords, records of luster and ecstasy. It made the body's means, the spirit's acolytes. A heavenlier function with a finer mode lit with its grace man's outward earthliness. The soul's experience of its deeper sheaths no more slept drugged by matter's dominance. In the dead wall closing us from wider self, into a secrecy of apparent sleep, the mystic tract beyond our waking thoughts, a door parted, built in by matter's force, releasing things unseized by earthly sense. A world unseen, unknown by outward mind, appeared in the silent spaces of the soul. He sat in secret chambers looking out into the luminous countries of the unborn, where all things dreamed by the mind are seen and true, and all that the life longs for is drawn close. He saw the perfect in their starry homes, wearing the glory of a deathless form, lain in the arms of the eternal's peace, wrapped in the heartbeats of God ecstasy. He lived in the mystic space where thought is born, and will is nursed by an ethereal power, and fed on the white milk of the eternal strength till it grows into the likeness of a god. In the witnesses' occult rooms with mind-built walls on hidden interiors, lurking passages open the windows of the inner sight. He owned the house of undivided time. Lifting the heavy curtain of the flesh, he stood upon a threshold, serpent-watched, and peered into gleaming, endless corridors, silent and listening in the silent heart for the coming of the new and the unknown. He gazed across the empty stillnesses and heard the footsteps of the undreamed idea in the far avenues of the beyond. He heard the secret voice, the word that knows, and saw the secret face that is our own. The inner planes uncovered their crystal doors. Strange powers and influences touched his life. A vision came of higher realms than ours, a consciousness of brighter fields and skies, of beings less circumscribed than brief-lived men, and subtler bodies than these passing frames. Objects too fine for our material grasp, acts vibrant with a superhuman light, and movements pushed by a superconscient force, and joys that never flowed through mortal limbs, and lovelier scenes than Earth's, and happier lives. A consciousness of beauty and of bliss, a knowledge which became what it perceived, replaced the separated sense and heart, and drew all nature into its embrace. The mind leaned out to meet the hidden worlds. Air glowed and teemed with marvelous shapes and hues. In the nostrils quivered celestial fragrances. On the tongue lingered the honey of paradise. The honey eater, the soul. Namaste, Jai Ma.